started off. The crowd joined in. After a few rounds, he offered his microphone out into the audience. "Pass it to her, pass it to her," Brenda chirped, wagging her finger at me like a happy puppy's tail. I took the mic and gave that woo-woo a special Mariah remix with all kinds of vocal flourishes. And in the end, I took the last woo way up into my high register and the whole crowd broke out in wild claps. That was the day Will Smith and I became friends. Will and I were both really young and looked it. Above my signature blown-out bangs, I had gathered the top portion of my unruly, crinkly hair into a yellow scrunchie, hair fanning out of it like a furry fountain, and let water and nature do their own thing with the back half of my do. I was wearing a little bubblegum pink tank dress that I had borrowed from Josephine. Will was tall and lanky, dressed as if he expected a pickup game of hoops could break out at any moment. He was incredibly friendly and funny, as was his charismatic friend, Charlie Mack. Immediately, I could tell that he was not only super talented, but really bright and laser-focused. I loved Parents Just Don't Understand and was very impressed with what he had accomplished. Will and I would sometimes hang out at Rascals below the apartment I shared with Josephine. He was an uncomplicated friend. Both of us were absolutely ambitious and still maintained a childlike wonder and curiosity about the world. Our relationship was always platonic and never got weird. After he heard me sing, Will believed in my talent. He took me with him to Def Jam Recordings, the hottest new hip-hop label at the time, where he was signed. As we walked down the street on our way to Def Jam, we saw this tall, thin white man approaching us. He stood out because he was kind of dancing and bopping with headphones on that were blasting music so loud you could hear it. "It takes two to make a thing go right." I later found out it was Lior Cohen who managed Run DMC and LL Cool J and signed Eric B. and Rakim and DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. It was a curious scene to me, this sinewy grown man dressed kind of cool singing aloud, "I want to rock right now." I was thinking, how does he even know this song? The Def Jam offices had a very downtown vibe. This was the label of many hot male hip-hop artists, so obviously there were a million girls going in and out. Most people probably just assumed that I was a groupie, strolling in on the arm of the Fresh Prince. Will had never heard my demo. He'd only heard me sing at the concert, but that was enough for him, I guess. Upstairs, we found ourselves with a junior executive who wanted me to sing. Once again, I may have looked a little shabby and young, but I was discerning enough to understand I wasn't going to sing for this random guy. I was grateful for Will's confidence, but I had my sights on a major label with a legacy of artists more in alignment with my singer-songwriter ambitions, somewhere huge like Warner or Columbia Records. That's where I knew I belonged, and that's where I believed I was going to be. My faith and focus were strong, but there was also evidence of my hard work, like a possible deal moving at Atlantic Records. During this time, the majors were reaping the benefits of their teen stars, the Tiffanys and Debbie Gibsons of the world. As the story goes, Doug Morris, the head of Atlantic, responded to my demo by saying, "We already have our teen girl," referring to Gibson. Clearly, he didn't really get it. For that matter, most labels didn't really get me. They really didn't know where I fit in. They didn't understand my sound. The demo had songs that didn't fit neatly into an existing genre. Though really young, I was definitely not teen pop. There was a bit of soul, R&B, and gospel infused into my music, and I had a hip-hop sensibility. My demo was more diverse than the music industry at the time. Then, of course, there was always the blondish, biracial elephant in the room. Executives at Motown supposedly reacted to my demo by saying, "Oh no, we don't want to deal with a Tina Marie situation again." Meaning they didn't want to force the general public to grapple with wondering if I was black or white or what. They didn't know how to market me. Most record executives just didn't know how they would work my record. They weren't sure it could, quote, cross over, but for the record, Tina Marie never cared about crossing over. And I didn't want to cross over either. I wanted to transcend. Cherchez la femme. One night, Brenda announced, "I'm going to take you to this party and you're going to meet a big record executive, Jerry Greenberg, and it's going to be great." "Sure, why not?" I thought. I was feeling enough professional confidence to let her drag me to an industry party. I was doing sessions and had a deal brewing at Warner's for one of my songs to be used in a movie. I wasn't too invested in this party being the party. While she had a generous heart, Brenda could also be pretty zany, so I sometimes took a lot of what she said with a grain of salt. We were going to get dressed at her house in Jersey, since she had all the clothes, makeup, and accessories from being on tour and having some money. She was supposed to pick me up from my apartment. I waited in my cramped vestibule, slumped on the tile floor for over an hour. Mind you, there was no texting back then. Finally, she appeared, revved up, full of energy, and ready to party. Her excitement was infectious. We started our going-out ritual in her large bathroom. Brenda had all the mousse, hairspray, combs, and curlers you could imagine. With her mixed Puerto Rican and Jewish heritage, I could certainly work with what she had. I attempted to create one long, uniform coil all around my head by twisting sections of hair around the rod of a curling wand. I finished it off with a straight bang. I borrowed a little black dress from her. What else? I had bought a pair of my own opaque black tights, but I couldn't fit into her shoes. They were too small. So I layered my black Van sneakers with ribbed, slouchy socks. I topped off the ensemble with my one statement piece, that Averex jacket from high school. I really tried with my look, and it was all right. Brenda told me the party was to celebrate a new record label, but since, by this time, I was interested in the big labels with the big boys and big artists, I didn't have high expectations about who would be in attendance. The new label was the collaboration of three well-known industry guys who had come together to form their own label, WTG Records. WTG stood for Walter, Tommy, and Gerald. It sounded like a tire business to me. I didn't really know who anybody was yet, but Brenda knew Jerry, Gerald Greenberg, who she told me was a big shot in the industry. In 1974, at 32, he became the youngest ever president of Atlantic Records. When she explained this, the party started to get a bit more interesting. I now understood why Brenda wanted me to bring my demo with me, not that I ever went anywhere without it. She'd brought me there to meet a guy from Atlantic Records. When we got to the party, I was surrounded by industry people, though I still had no clue what that meant. As I walked around, I took in the scene. Some handlers were traipsing a female artist around like a show horse. She was very blonde, very pretty, very white, and very dolled up and coiffed, with a flurry of label folks forming a tight, buzzing cloud around her. There were large, blown-up pictures of her all over the room. I guess we were supposed to ooh and ah in her presence, but I wasn't interested in her. I was just thinking, who is she? Why should I be excited? To me, she was just someone they were toting around. Frankly, I was unimpressed by the whole scene. Brenda and I sat down at a table. We were trying to have a good time in the room full of suits, but all I could think was that I could be at the studio working on songs or something. That was where I always wanted to be. We got up to go to the bathroom, making our way through the crowd to get to the staircase that led to where the restrooms were. As we bounced up the stairs, I saw him. He wasn't anyone I would have normally noticed, not particularly tall or short, not stylish or tacky. I'm pretty sure he had on a suit. He would have been totally forgettable if it weren't for his eyes. Our eyes locked, and an energy instantly rushed between us like a mild electric shock. He had a piercing stare. He looked into me, not at me. I was a little shook, not in a bad way, but not in a love-at-first-sight way either. I kept going up the stairs, this time at a slower pace, as I adjusted to what had just happened. When I closed the bathroom door, the odd sensation was still pulsing through me. What had happened? I didn't know who he was, but I recognized him somehow. I knew it wasn't from TV or anything like that. It wasn't his face. It was something else. I recognized his energy, and I think he recognized mine. Brenda was all excited. Did you see how Tommy Mottola looked at you? I did, she said, her eyes wide. Who's Tommy Mottola? I asked. Girl, she looked at me quizzically, a sense of seriousness about her. Who's Tommy Mottola? She began to sing a familiar refrain. Tommy Mottola lives on the road. You don't know who that is? You don't know that song? I shook my head. She sang a little bit more. Oh, shay, 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 shay. It hit me. Oh, yeah, I know that song. I joined in. Oh, shay, 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 shay. It was Shay Shay La Femme, C'est C'est Bon by Dr. Buzzard's original Savannah band. I let her know that I used to like that song when I was a little girl. Brenda said, that is the Tommy from the song. He's one of the biggest record guys ever. Brenda and I headed over to the spot where they were all standing. I was standing by wondering, if he was such a big shot, what did he want with me? The party was filled with prettier girls with professional makeup and far better footwear. Tommy said to Brenda, "Who's your friend?" The most intense three words I'd ever heard. Brenda directed her answer to Jerry. "She's 18 years old. Her name is Mariah. You gotta listen to this." Just as she went to hand Jerry my demo tape, Tommy's hand swiftly cut her off mid-extension. He snatched the tape, got up, left the table, and left the party. It was bizarre and bewildering. I was like, what kind of shit is that? That was an important demo. It had some of my best songs, All in Your Mind, Someday, and Alone in Love. Had this Tommy guy just taken all that work and money? I wasn't sitting there thinking, yay, I just gave my demo to a big-time record executive. I was focused more on the fact that I was out one more copy of my demo. I know this Tommy guy's never going to listen to it, I thought. The popular story goes that Tommy left the party to get in his limo, where he could immediately listen to the demo. I didn't know what was the reason he left the party so abruptly, but after he did, I was ready to leave too. So I did. Eventually, Tommy came back looking for me, apparently not believing what he had just heard had come from that same girl on the stairs, the innocent-looking kid in Vans and slouchy socks. All those dressed-up girls in high heels were working so hard to get the attention of W, T, or G, and T came back looking for me. Tommy was already the president of Sony Music, so getting my phone number was nothing. He called me and left a message on my answering machine. Josephine and I made performance art out of goofing around and doing silly voices on that answering machine. I'd come in from the studio at 5 in the morning, and we'd make these crazy messages. In the one Tommy heard, I was mimicking her Swedish accent. "If this is the super, we need some help here. We have flies in our cat's tails, and there's no hot water," followed by hysterical laughter. It was funny to us, but it was also the truth. The conditions in our apartment were pretty gross. We had sticky flypaper hanging from the ceiling and on the walls, which our cats would brush up against. We really didn't have hot water either. It was a mess. But we were young, giddy girls, and we made a joke out of our circumstances. The first time Tommy called, he hung up. But he didn't give up. He called back and this time left a curt and serious-sounding message. "Tommy Mottola, CBS, Sony Records." He left a number. "Call me back." I couldn't believe it. I immediately called Brenda, who confirmed that indeed Tommy's office had called her manager and he wanted to sign me. This was the first of what would be a strange and fantastical series of Cinderella stories in my life. But I was not swept off my feet, and trust and believe me, Tommy Mottola was no Prince Charming. Princess Prisoner. Once I was a prisoner, lost inside myself, with the world surrounding me. I am free. Once upon a time, I lived in a very big house named Storybook Manor, and in it were big diamonds and big closets full of the most spectacular gowns and bejeweled slippers. But also, within its walls, was an inescapable emptiness, bigger than everything else inside, that almost swallowed me whole. This was no place for Cinderella. If there were a fairy tale that could come close to describing my life, it would be The Three Little Pigs. My childhood was a series of fragile, unstable houses, one after the other, where inevitably the big bad wolf, my troubled brother, would huff and puff and blow it all down. I never felt safe. I never was safe. His rage was unpredictable. I never knew when it would come or who or what it would devour. What I did know was that I was truly on my own, out there in the wild woods of the world. I knew that if I was ever going to find a safe place, I would have to make it myself. I remember the very first time I ever felt I was in something like a safe place. I was living on my own in New York City in a one-room studio apartment on the 10th floor with a spectacular view. The building was called Chelsea Court. I loved the name of that building. It had such a regal ring to it. I could see the Empire State Building from my apartment window, my little apartment, the first that was all mine. I had just gotten my very first artist advance. It was $5,000, which is a number I'll never forget. $5,000 was more money than I'd ever seen at once, let alone had to call my own and spend as I wished. As soon as I got that advance, I got my own apartment. I could finally pay my own rent. No more living in nooks and crannies. No more sleeping on floors or sharing cramped bathrooms with four or five other girls. The first thing I did was buy my own new little couch with four stable legs. Sometimes I would just stroke the fabric on the arm of my new little couch as if it were a baby. It was that major for me. I upgraded from a mattress on the floor to my own bed. I had a little kitchen. I had the two cats, Tompkins and Ninja. I had a little peace. I was having a moment, and I felt like I could toss my raspberry beret in the air and do a twirl in the street with my laundry bag because I had survived. I survived the danger. I survived the hunger. I survived the uncertainty and instability. And now here I was, every day coming closer and closer to my destiny. I was independent in New York City, in my own apartment, filled with my own furniture, working on my own album, filled with all of my own songs. I could have my own friends over. It was my first taste of autonomy, and it was divine, but it would not last long. In the beginning, Tommy protected me. Even though I was breathing a bit easier, with some early breaks and a clear path to success, the traumas and insecurities of my childhood and pressure from my brother and other people trying to take advantage of me were still right at my back, haunting my every move. I never stopped looking over my shoulder. Tommy shielded me from all the people who thought I owed them something or who wanted to use me. That meant Tommy also protected me from my own family. I was 19 years old and had already lived a lifetime of chaos, surviving only by my own scrappy determination. Then, this powerful man suddenly came along, parting the seas to make room for my dream. He truly believed in me. With all due respect, Tommy Mottola was just the bitter pill I needed to swallow at a pivotal period in my life. And there is a lot of respect due to him. He was a visionary music executive who fearlessly and ferociously dragged his visions into reality. He believed in me ruthlessly. "You're the most talented person I've ever met," he would say to me. "You could be as big as Michael Jackson." I heard music in the way he said that name, Michael Jackson. Here was a man who had played a large role in advancing the careers of some of the biggest names in the industry, and he saw me sharing the same rare air as the most influential artist and entertainer in modern history. Respect. And it wasn't a sales pitch or a cheap come-on. It was real. We didn't play when it came to the work. My career as an artist was the most important thing to me. It was the only thing. It validated my very existence, and Tommy understood the power of my commitment. I was serious and ambitious. He knew my vocals were unique and strong, but he was most impressed with how I created songs, the structure of my melodies, the music. I became his new star, just as he was beginning a huge position at a new label, so he had the influence to clear the runway for my ascension into the sky. He was willing to move heaven and earth to make me successful. I recognized and respected that power. Despite having been around some of the biggest names in the music industry, Tommy told me I was the most talented person he had ever met. He was for real. And I really believed him. Soon after we met, Tommy started making romantic overtures. At first, they were a bit awkward and adolescent, like sending me expensive gunned teddy bears. Yet, his persistent gestures and constant attention also gave me a sense of safety. Tommy had a brazen confidence I had never seen up close. He impressed me, and I saw him as a truly empowered person, which I found very attractive. Underneath the shine, however, I had some inkling that there was a darker energy that came with him, a price to pay for his protection. But at 19, I was willing to pay it. For me, Tommy was a potent combination of father figure, Svengali, business partner, confidant, and companion. There was never really a strong sexual or physical attraction there, but at the time, I needed safety and stability, a sense of home, more than I needed a boyfriend. Tommy understood that, and he provided. I gave him my work and my trust. I gave him my conviction and the combination to my moral code. The relationship was intense and all-encompassing. After all, we already worked together, which was how we spent most of our time. When we weren't working, we were dining at high-end steakhouses or infamous Italian restaurants or attending industry events together. I was spending less and less time at my Chelsea apartment and began spending most nights with him. Soon, I felt pressure from Tommy to give up my place, and against my better instincts, I gave in. Little did I know that relinquishment would mark the beginning of a slow and steady march into captivity. Little did I know giving into Tommy's demands would gradually swallow my privacy and begin to erase my identity. On weekends, we drove up to Tommy's farmhouse in Hillsdale, New York, which I eventually affectionately came to call Hills Jail. On the night I got my first publishing advance for $1 million, $1 million buys a lot of H&H bagels, Tommy drove us up the Taconic Parkway and pulled up before a gorgeous piece of land. He stopped the car and told me to get out. I looked at the sprawling expanse, shivering in the autumn breeze. It really was stunning. "Let's build a house here," Tommy proclaimed. I knew what this translated to. This is where we are building our house. I had no idea the scope of what I was getting myself into. Now, this was no Hills Jail. It was impressive and majestic. 50 acres of fertile green land adjacent to a nature preserve in Bedford, New York. It was sandwiched between properties belonging to Ralph Lauren and a very prominent billionaire, an area guaranteed to be secure. But, as I would soon discover, the concept of security was about to turn on me. I hadn't ever wanted to leave the city, but that's what we were doing. Outside of the recording studio, I wondered, when would I ever be back in my beloved Manhattan? Certainly, building a new house would be a monumental undertaking, but it did have a strong appeal to me, creatively and emotionally. After a childhood of being uprooted and plopped into all kinds of precarious living arrangements, I finally had the chance to build my own from the foundation. I got excited. I got into it. I insisted on being fully involved in all aspects of the design, and I also insisted on paying half of all the costs. I wanted it to be my house. I had fresh memories of witnessing my mother go through the humiliation of a boyfriend shouting, "Get out of my house!" I told myself that no man would ever do that to me, ever. Much of what I learned from my mother and older sister was what I wasn't going to do when I grew up. I had very little guidance in what to do as a woman, though I'd been forced into adult situations when I was still quite young. Tommy was 21 years older than me. He could have been my father. He was also the head of my label. There was no wise woman around me to point out that the power dynamic in our relationship was nowhere near 50-50, so maybe I should think twice about going in 50-50 with him on an expensive piece of property. To top it all off, we were not yet married. But I was young, and I was all the way in with Tommy. I was proud of making my own money, though I had no real concept of money. I'd recently received an enormous royalty check from sales of my debut album, so I thought I was set for life. Building a dream house with Tommy did not seem like a risk. I was selling millions of records by then, but I didn't know that our dream mansion would come with an unfathomable $30 million price tag. And as it turned out, my time in that house with Tommy would end up costing me so much more than money. I did love the process of building that grand manor in Bedford. It opened up a new area of passion in me. I was finally able to give life to my childhood obsession with old Hollywood movies. Ironically, I was especially influenced by How to Marry a Millionaire, starring Betty Grable, Lauren Bacall, and Marilyn Monroe, of course. The images of palatial arched windows and glamorous glossy floors were seared into my little girl imagination. I made sure every room in our house was pristine and spacious, filled with air and sparkling with light. We worked closely with the designers and architects. We went over every detail together. I taught myself a lot about the stylings of moldings and tiles. I became an expert in sconces. Sconces, darling. I also learned a lot about materials and would often visit various rock quarries. Though by no stretch do I like a rustic look, I do have a preference for tumbled marble on my kitchen floors. I was very particular and confident about what I liked. Naive as I was at the time, I decided I was going to build a great house. I had come from far too little to complain. Oh, poor me. I have to build a mansion. I was into it. After all, I sincerely thought I would be with Tommy forever and that the home we would make together would be just as timeless, everlasting, and spectacular as the music we were creating, behind which, of course, I was also the creative force. And spectacular it was. We even had a ballroom. I was in my early 20s with my own ballroom. I built a grand closet inspired by Coco Chanel's closet in her 31 Rue Cambon flat in Paris, full of opulent mirrors and a spiral staircase that led to its own shoe section. I had acquired so many shoes through all my photo and video shoots that I had to build entire walls of shelving for them. It was staggering to think that just a few short years before, I had been walking in my mother's too small, beat-up shoes, snow pouring in through cracks in the soles. I kept those dismal ankle boots for a while with the intention to bronze them like baby booties so I would never forget where I came from, as if that were even an option. In such a short time, I had gone from raggedy hand-me-downs to my own manor, complete with walls custom-built for an entire footwear collection. My faith in my fans blessed me with unimaginable riches. I was immensely grateful, but despite that huge accomplishment, I had yet to learn that in reality, I just provided the design inspiration and put up half the money to build my own prison. The magnificent compound I built in Bedford was just over 10 miles from the village of Ossining, another quaint, wooded Westchester town, home to the most famous maximum security prison in New York State and possibly in the country. Sing Sing, a complex of grim stone and brick on 130 acres, landscaped with grand elm trees. Sing Sing sits formidably on the eastern bank of the Hudson River. The roller coaster-like arches of the Tappan Zee Bridge can be seen from the watchtower. In autumn, the views are breathtaking. The trees burn fiery orange, gold, and red. Sing Sing confines about 2,000 human beings. The popular terms for being locked up, being upstate or up the river or in the big house, were coined at Sing Sing. No matter how prime the real estate, how grandiose the structure, if it's designed to monitor movement and contain the human spirit, it will serve only to diminish and demoralize those held inside. None of the irony of my proximity to the infamous prison, nor that of its peculiar name, was lost on me. Jokingly, I referred to the Bedford estate as Sing Sing. It was fully staffed with armed guards, security cameras were installed in most rooms, and Tommy was in control. While I was building Sing Sing, I thought it would be a healthy idea to have my mother and my nephews, Mike and Sean, live closer to me. I loved the process of designing and creating a gorgeous home. While I had little freedom at Sing Sing, Tommy did support me buying a house nearby for my mother. It became a big thing for us to talk about, and he eventually understood how important it was to me to try and create something stable for my family. I later found out he secretly had security follow me around whenever I went to look at houses or run errands, but I was grateful for the small window of ignorance. That child in me, deep down, still dreamed of a family that wasn't fractured. I had begun to make my career dreams come true, and I thought maybe I could make us a family home, a home base where everyone was always welcome, and I'd make my mother the head of it. I got excited about the idea of buying a home my mother would love, and I could finally afford to do it in style. Finding the perfect house for her was my new project. Just like I wanted every bit of my house to reflect me, I was determined to put that attention to detail into the house for my mother. I wanted her to love where she was going to live. We recruited friends of Tommy's in real estate to help me find a place nearby. They showed me several lovely homes, but I was holding out for the right thing, for her. My taste leaned more old Hollywood, and hers was more old Woodstock. After an extensive search within a 20-minute radius of our estate, we finally rolled up on a deeply wooded property with a house set far back from the road. It wasn't meticulously manicured, which was typical of that section of Upper Westchester. Rather, the landscaping was intentionally organic. The 6 green acres were filled with splendid old oak trees, and the house blended into the nature around it beautifully. The interior was both spacious and cozy, with warm wood tones and soothing light streaming through the gracious windows. Once inside, you couldn't hear or see the outside world. I had found the only hippie opera singer dream cabin in the woods in Westchester. It was perfection, and I knew exactly what to do to bring it to life. I took it on like I was an interior designer on one of those makeover shows. I picked out and paid for every piece of brand new furniture, all the knickknacks and accoutrements. I chose every detail from light fixtures to paint colors, all in Pat's palette. I hung wooden flower boxes outside and filled them with romantic wildflowers. I got photo prints made of her Irish family members and Irish crests, had them mounted and framed, and hung them ascending the wall along the staircase. And I managed to keep it secret from her. The biggest challenge was getting her piano in without her knowing. I knew it was important that it was her old blonde wood Yamaha upright that would be in the living room, not a shiny new model. Her piano held memories in its keys. It was a symbol because it was a significant, stable object she provided during my turbulent childhood. I made up some story that I was going to get it tuned or something before it went into storage. I even had her sign fake moving documents so it could be taken away without suspicion. Her old piano would be the piece de resistance in her cabin in the Westchester woods. One of the details that sold me on the property was a wooden sign that had the words Cabin in the Woods carved into it. The sellers didn't want to part with it, but I fought tooth and nail because I just knew my mother would love it. I got so much joy from making plans, keeping the secret, and working to make everything just so. Growing up, I had always wanted a family house where I wouldn't be embarrassed to bring my friends. Creating a place where my mother could live comfortably and the whole family could gather was so special, healing even. It was like preparing a spectacular Christmas for my mother and family. I was giddy with excitement when it was time to present the house I had created to my mother. I was proud of the work that I had done. To me, this house was also testimony to my ability to hold on to childhood desires, proof that the trauma and danger I had faced hadn't destroyed my hope. My mother thought she was coming up to Sing Sing for one of our semi-regular dinners. When I picked her up, I told her I had to swing by Tommy's friend Carol's house, which was nearby. When the wrought iron gates I had installed swung open like welcoming arms from the stone pillars and we entered the property, I felt my mother go still, then heard her take a deep breath. Trees will do that, make you stop and breathe. She moved out of the car as if the fresh air was making her slow down. She looked up at the house in all its beauty. I watched her take in the grace of the flower boxes. And as Carol opened the front door, the aroma of rich coffee and hot cinnamon buns drifted past us. I had orchestrated it to be brewing and baking when we arrived, as I wanted those details to set the mood. My mother stood in the doorway and softly said, "Oh, Carol, your house is beautiful." Playing right along, Carol offered to show her around, and I followed behind. When we got to the staircase, my mother paused at the photos, but I could tell it didn't quite register. So I broke her trance. "Mom, look at who's in the pictures." She was struck with utter confusion as she noticed her family on Carol's wall. Faintly, she replied, "I don't understand." "This is all for you. This is where you live now," I said. She was speechless, and I was the proudest I'd ever been. Mike, who I completely treasure, was still quite little then. He went tearing through the house and out to the backyard, running along the plush grass, squealing with delight. He was full of such pure joy, and is still such a source of joy to me. He was free, a little boy playing in the afternoon breeze with no filth, just free. We had come full circle, from swinging over trash heaps or being thrown out like garbage, or so I thought. Along with the ballroom and couture shoe closets of Sing Sing, I built a fantastic, state-of-the-art recording studio. Adjacent to the studio was a huge Roman-style swimming pool of white marble inside of a grand parlor. In these two places, I found solace and solitude. They were a temporary reprieve and a chance to feel weightless, in the recording studio and in the water. But the studio, the pool, and I were all still confined, enclosed within the bounds of Sing Sing's fortress. Under ordinary circumstances, the chance to have my own studio custom-made to my exact specifications and at my disposal at any time would have been liberating. In the early days of my career, I was at the mercy of other people to get studio time, grateful to be in grim little spaces, singing songs I didn't like, bartering, doing whatever it took to get my songs recorded. And now I had my own fully equipped, gorgeous recording studio. I imagined I could have my own sessions when I wanted to and call in the artist I wanted to work with, like Prince did. Sing Sing wasn't Paisley Park, but it was fabulous, and it was mine. Well, half mine. There was a studio with sophisticated recording equipment, but there was also very sophisticated security equipment outfitted throughout the house, listening devices, motion detecting cameras, recording my every move. A family. So when you feel like hope is gone, look inside you and be strong, and you'll finally see the truth. That a hero lies in you. Hero. It was the middle of July, 1993, and I was headed to Schenectady, New York, to record a Thanksgiving special for NBC. It was the first event to kick off promotion for my soon-to-be-released third studio album, Music Box. The first single, Dream Lover, would be dropping in a week, and the full album would be released on the last day of August. Schenectady, a typical industrial city in eastern New York, was largely made up of Eastern European immigrants and Black folks who had come from the South to work in the town's cotton mill. It's a straight shot north along the Hudson River from Hillsdale. The concert was to be taped at Proctor's Theater, a former vaudeville house complete with a red carpet, gold leaf galore, Corinthian columns, chandeliers, and Louis XV couches in the balcony promenade. The whole nine yards. Even though it was a beautiful classic theater, it was not the setting I would have chosen, to be sure, nor would most 20-year-olds in the early 1990s. But I made few decisions about my whereabouts then. Outside of the recording studio, every aspect of my life was decided by a committee in those days, with Tommy acting as chairman of the board. Oddly enough, I was never invited to the meetings. As we pulled up to the center of town, the streets seemed to be increasingly empty, and I began to notice a lot of police officers. Several streets were blocked off near the theater, patrolled by clusters of men in dark uniforms, outfitted with shiny shoes and black guns. The limo slowed to a crawl as I stared out the window, the eerily quiet streets rolling by. A familiar anxiety was rising inside, which I fought mightily to contain. I had to mentally prepare to present new songs in front of new people, a performance that would be televised to millions on a major network. I knew I couldn't let my anxiety develop into fear. With the exception of the cops, who had called all these cops? I had my own security with me. In fact, I always had security with me. The street behind the theater, where the backstage door was located, was desolate. Before I was quickly whisked into my gilded dressing room, I caught a glimpse of crowds of people behind barricades. Though I now had a moment to settle in, I still felt anxious. Eventually, I asked why the streets were blocked off and full of police. What in the world was happening in downtown Schenectady on this hot midsummer day? "Miss Carey," they told me, "it's for you. It's because you're coming to do the show." Apparently, masses of young fans were crowding the streets, hoping to catch a glimpse of me. At first, I couldn't fully digest this response. What did they mean? The barricades, the squads of police, the emptied streets were because of me? My first album, Mariah Carey, had come out 3 years prior to hitting and holding the number one spot on the Billboard 200 for 11 consecutive weeks, remaining on the list for 113 weeks in total, with four singles going number one back to back. I had won Grammys for Best New Artist and the Best Female Pop Vocal Performance and received nominations for both Song of the Year and Record of the Year for Vision of Love, which I performed on the Arsenio Hall Show, Good Morning America, The Tonight Show, and The Oprah Winfrey Show. The album would go on to sell 9 million copies in the United States alone and was still selling all over the world. It would go on to sell more than 15 million copies. My second album, Emotions, had been released just the year before. I particularly adored working with David Cole, one half of the fab CNC Music Factory. He was a church kid who loved dance music, as evidenced on Make It Happen. As a producer, he pushed me as a singer because he was one too. I released an EP with live versions of songs from my first two albums for the wildly popular show MTV Unplugged. It included a remake of the classic Jackson 5 hit, I'll Be There, featuring my background singer and friend, Trey Lorenz. The song quickly shot to number one after the show, making it my fifth number one single and the second time I'll Be There held the coveted spot. I performed Emotions at the MTV Video Music Awards and the Soul Train Music Awards. And here I was again, about to hit another stage, and somehow I had no clue that I was famous. For four solid years of my life, I was writing, singing, producing, and doing photo shoots, video shoots, press junkets, and promotional tours. All the awards and accolades I received were handed out in highly coordinated industry settings. It just seemed to be part of the work. If I had any free time, I was sequestered in an old farmhouse up in the Hudson Valley. Tommy orchestrated all of it. I was in my early 20s. Because I was never alone, I had no comprehension of the impact my music and I were making on the outside world. I never had time to think or reflect. I now believe that this was completely by design. Did Tommy know I would be easier to control if I were kept ignorant of the full scope of my power? I'm told that in the music box era, as a gift to me, my then makeup artist Billy B and hairstylist Sid Curry made a thoughtful scrapbook for me in which they gathered little notes of love and appreciation from other artists or celebrities they worked with or saw in their travels. Joey Lawrence, remember Joey from Blossom, who was such a heartthrob at the time, apparently left a significantly sweet message. Well, Tommy saw the love fest of a book, ripped it up, and burnt it in the fireplace before I was able to see it. A childish act of cruelty, especially to Billy and Sid, who went through all that effort to prove to me how big I was, even among the stars. With no parental or familial management or protection, I was easy to manipulate, but the dynamic of my relationship with Tommy was complex. In many ways, Tommy protected me from my dysfunctional family, but he went to the extreme. He controlled and patrolled me. Yet his control also meant that in these early years, all my focus, all my energy, and all my passion went into writing, producing, and singing my songs. Tommy and his stranglehold on my movements seemed a fair price to pay for getting to do the work I had always dreamed of. He had my life, but I had my music. It wasn't until that moment in Schenectady that I began to realize the degree of my popularity. I had fans, and soon they would become another source of my strength. In the dressing room, where I sat in a chair, having my hair first straightened, then curled and sprayed, the magnitude of what I had just learned began to sink in. The police were not around because of some violent or dangerous incident. They were there to make a clear way for me. My family may not have provided me safety, my relationship may not have given me security, but realizing that there was a multitude of people showing up and pouring out love for me gave me a new kind of confidence. Because Tommy never allowed me to experience the glamorous privileges granted to the young, rich, and popular, the fame I discovered was solely defined through my relationship to my fans and their relationship to my music. I decided that day that I was prepared to be devoted to them forever. The Thanksgiving special was titled Here is Mariah Carey, and I was going to debut three new songs from Music Box, Dream Lover, Anytime You Need a Friend, and Hero, along with some of my known hits, Emotions, Make It Happen, and of course, Vision of Love. I had always written songs from an honest place, using my own lived experiences and dreams as a source. I also pushed my vocals to their extreme. I was also going to debut Hero. It's always a risk to debut songs at a live show that people have not had the opportunity to connect with through radio repetition. Even though I wrote Hero, it wasn't originally intended for me to perform. I was asked to write something for the movie Hero, starring Dustin Hoffman and Gina Davis. Tommy had agreed I would submit a song for the film to be sung by Gloria Estefan, who was on Epic Records. Sony, Tommy's label, was the parent company. I knew that Luther Vandross was also writing a song for the soundtrack, so I would be in great company. I hunkered down in Right Track, or the Hit Factory, one of the major studios where I had spent a major fortune. I was there that day with Walter Afanasieff. The plot of the film was explained to everyone in the studio in 5 minutes. A pilot goes around and rescues people. That's about all I absorbed. Shortly after, I got up to go to the bathroom, one of the few activities I did unaccompanied by someone on Tommy's payroll. I lingered in the stall to luxuriate in my fleeting moment of peace. Savoring my time, I slowly walked down the hall to return to the studio. As I walked, a melody and some words came clearly into my mind. As soon as I got back into the room, I sat right down at the piano and said to Walter, "This is how it goes." I hummed the tune and some of the lyrics. As Walter worked to find the basic chords, I began to sing. "And then a hero comes along." I guided him through what I had heard so vividly in my head. Hero was created for a mainstream movie to be sung by a singer with a very different style and range than my own. Honestly, though, I felt the message and the melody were fairly generic. I also felt it fit the bill. We recorded a rough demo, which I found a bit schmaltzy. But Tommy heard the potential for a classic. He insisted not only that we keep the song, but that it was going on my new album. I was like, okay, I'm glad he likes it. I finessed the song and made changes to the lyrics to make it more personal. For that, I went to the well of my memories and dipped into that moment when Nana Reese had told me to hold on to my dreams. I did my best to reclaim it, but it was a gift, no matter who it was for. By the time of the Schenectady show, Hero had lost its simplicity and gained some depth. The initial trepidation I felt about singing it live for the first time in front of an audience was melting away as I thought about all the people who had lined the streets and packed the theater to see me that night. I decided that this song did not actually belong to Gloria Estefan, a movie, Tommy, or me. Hero belonged to my fans, and I was going to deliver it to them with all I had. The Thanksgiving special included inner-city kids from a local community organization. I saw the kids backstage, brimming with both promise and fear, and in them, I saw me. I would sing this song for them too. The concert opened with my latest hit, Emotions, upbeat and embellished with lots of my signature super high notes. As I was singing Emotions, and through the several stops and retakes required, singing live for TV recording is tedious work, I was able to really look at the people in the crowd. This was Schenectady, and these were real folks, not paid seat fillers or trendily dressed extras, but authentic, mostly young people with that unmistakable hunger and adoration in their eyes. I saw them for who they were, and they were me. I closed my eyes and said a prayer. As the first few chords of the piano intro played, I started to hum from my heart. When I opened my mouth, Hero was released into the world. Some of us need to be rescued, but everyone wants to be seen. I sang Hero directly to the faces I could see from the stage. I saw tears well up in their eyes and hope rise up in their spirits. Whatever cynicism I had about the song was gone after that night, but Tommy, too, had noticed the size of its impact. Later that year, on December 10th, 1993, when I performed Hero at Madison Square Garden, I announced that all stateside sales proceeds would be donated to the families of victims of the Long Island Railroad shooting, which had happened 3 days prior. On a train, a route I'd ridden before, a man pulled out a 9mm pistol and opened fire, killing 6 people and wounding 19. 3 brave men, Kevin Blum, Mark McGinty, and Michael O'Connor, subdued him, thus preventing more slaughter. They were heroes, and so I dedicated Hero to them that night. Just 10 days after the September 11 attacks, I sang the song as part of the America, A Tribute to Heroes telethon. And on January 20, 2009, I had the unthinkable, unparalleled honor of singing it at the inaugural ball of the first African-American president of the United States of America. To this day, Hero is one of my most performed songs. Music Box would go on to reach diamond status in the United States, and it's one of the highest-selling albums of all time. And here's a side note with a side eye. A couple of people have come for Hero and for me with both royalties and plagiarism claims. 3 times I have been to court and 3 times the cases have been thrown out. The first time, the poor fool going after me had to pay a fine. Initially, I felt victimized, knowing how purely the song came to me. But after a while, I almost began to expect lies and lawsuits to come with my success from strangers and from my own family and friends. And they won't stop. The taping that night in Schenectady took several hours. A television show has so many technical needs, multiple cameras, close-ups, far and cutaway shots, costume changes, hair and makeup touch-ups, extras, audience reactions. It's a production. When we finally wrapped, I said all my thank yous to the kids, the choir, the orchestra, and the crew. Then, just as I had come in, I was whisked out the backstage door, which seemed to lead not to the street, but straight to the limo. I plopped into the back seat, buzzing from a contradictory cocktail of exhaustion and exhilaration. As we pulled out into the street, I noticed that where there was once emptiness and a scattering of barricades, there were now crowds of people swelling over the flimsy metal partitions, screaming my name and, "We love you!" I noticed the cops, too, standing there unfazed in the pulsing midst of the energy and excitement. It was one thing to be informed, but quite another to see with my own eyes, hear with my own ears, and feel in my soul the reaction from real people to me and my music. What I felt that night in Schenectady was not idol worship, it was love. It was the kind of love that comes from honest connection and recognition. I was mesmerized as I looked out the window, watching all these people shower me with such love. Not just fans, a family. As the crowd faded from sight and we neared the outskirts of town, approaching the highway, my high began to wear off. And by the time the wheels touched the tar of the Taconic Parkway, the mood in the car had returned to its routine gloom. Most Thursday evenings, Tommy and I would ride up the southern stretch of this highway, leaving glamorous Manhattan behind to spend the weekend in Hillsdale. As the lights and high-rises shrank in the rearview mirror and the magnetic pull of the city dimmed, a part of my life force grew faint as well. When the car radio, which stayed locked on Hot 97, their then slogan, blazing hip-hop and R&B, would begin to break up, muffled by static, I knew my life as a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, 20-something, was over. Every weekend, Tommy would turn off the radio that was my lifeline and take a moment of silence before popping in one of his beloved Frank Sinatra CDs. What a tragic metaphor listening to Tommy hum My Way as he drove us back to my captivity. I was conditioned to either talk shop or go silent on our bleak commute. Mostly, though, I just stared out the window at the Grand Hudson River, preparing for my first major role, contented wife-to-be. This was the only acting job Tommy ever encouraged. Taking acting classes or accepting roles in movies or on TV was strictly forbidden. On the ride back from Schenectady, I don't recall Tommy and me discussing what had just happened. Perhaps he knew that I saw the purity and power of the fans, that I discovered how their love couldn't be controlled. It is fans who create a phenomenon, not record company executives. Tommy was smart. He knew. But I don't know if he realized that after that moment, I finally did too. We arrived at the farmhouse, and all I wanted to do was take a bath. Being a performer is a production. You build up and put on. You strategize, manipulate, accommodate, and shapeshift. It requires rituals, sometimes in the form of bad habits, to return yourself back to yourself. My ritual was to wash the performer off. The addition of a large tub facing an expansive picture window was one of the few contributions I got to make to Hills Jail. The bathroom was my refuge, since putting a camera or intercom in there would have been a bit much, even for Tommy. The cool marble tiles sent a soothing sensation through my bare feet, which had been hoisted up in heels all night. I lazily peeled off my ensemble, thankful that the sound of the water running was the only one I heard. I lowered the overhead lights and ceremoniously lit a few white candles. The water was welcoming, and I surrendered. As if being baptized, I submerged my head and lingered in the warm, dark quiet. I gently rose up, tilted my head back, and propped my arms along the edge of the massive basin, eyelids still shut, savoring every moment of this calm solitude. Slowly, I opened my eyes to a radiant, full moon, glowing against a clear blue-black sky. Softly, I began to sing, da-da-da-da-da. Images of the scene I had just left, adoring fans screaming and crying, flashed through my mind, blending with painful recollections of my brother screaming and my mother crying, of myself as a lonely little girl in a neglected dress. I was floating in a tub that was larger than the size of my entire living area just 5 years before, in a room bigger than all of the living rooms in all of the 13 places I lived with my mother growing up. The enormity, complexity, and instability of the road I had traveled to get into this bath hit me. It was the first time I felt safe enough to go back and peek in on Mariah, the little one, and recognize what she had survived. And suddenly, the first verse and chorus of Close My Eyes came to me.
I was a wayward child with the weight of the world that I held deep inside. Life was a winding road and I learned many things little one shouldn't know, but I closed my eyes, steady my feet on the ground, raise my head to the sky, and the times roll by. Still I feel like a child as I look at the moon. Maybe I grew up a little too soon.
It would take me years to finish this song. Years of anguish and survival. My big fat Sony wedding and little skinny honeymoon. To announce our engagement, Tommy and I took my mother to a swanky dinner in Midtown Manhattan. As we walked outside after the meal, the city was all dressed up in its evening wear of bright lights and flashing billboards, and I showed her the engagement ring, a Cartier tricolor gold band with an immaculate, modest-sized diamond. It was understated, but it was also Cartier. My mother looked at the delicate, dazzling ring on my slender and very young finger and quietly said, "You deserve it." That was it. She got into the limo I had waiting for her and rode away. I never really knew what she meant by that, but that was all that was left between us. There was no womanly advice or girlish giggles, which, honestly, I didn't expect, but I did think the occasion called for more than a one-liner. Many reasonable people have questioned why I married Tommy, but none of them questioned the decision more than I did. I knew I would lose more power as a person, and I was already completely suffocating emotionally in the relationship. We were equally yoked to each other through the music and the business. However, the personal power dynamic between us was never equal. He convinced me that everything would be better if we were married, that things would be different. But what I really hoped for was that he would be different, that if I gave him this thing he so adamantly wanted, this marriage that I believed he thought would legitimize him or quell chatter about him having an affair with an artist on the label, it would change him. I was never completely sure why he wanted to get married so badly. I prayed that in doing so, he would calm down and loosen his vice grip on my life. I hoped maybe he would trust his wife and let her breathe. I was in my early 20s, just a few years removed from the shack, and the concept of a life that included both personal and professional fulfillment was unfathomable to me. I truly believed that I was not worthy of both happiness and success. I was accustomed to making all my life choices based on survival. Back then, I didn't choose what glamorous outfit to wear each morning. I chose what survival mechanism I needed to arm myself with that day. More than my personal happiness, I needed my career as an artist to survive. Happiness was secondary. Happiness was a fleeting bonus. I married Tommy because I thought it was the only way for me to survive in that relationship. I saw the power he could put behind my music, and he saw the power my music could give him. Our holy matrimony was built on creativity and vulnerability. I respected Tommy as a partner. If only he had known how to give me the respect I was.